Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan. And today, EcoNet News, Volume 26, Issue Number 10, October 2024. The title of the issue is Big and Small Solar. Quote of the month: we're phasing out coal-fired heat and replacing it with carbon-neutral district heating produced from wind and seawater. The switch will save around 120,000 tons of CO2 emissions per year and support Denmark's effort to integrate electric renewables into the grid. Kenneth Jorgensen, Project Director, DIN Forskning, Esbjerg, Denmark. Flanagan's net positive: really big and really small solar. Miles of solar. Solar for as far as the eye can see. A gigawatt currently, with another gigawatt to come. EcoMotion hired to inspect remediation efforts on a multi-hundred megawatt solar system, many, many blocks of solar arrays. We're far from the residential rooftops of Santa Monica where EcoMotion began in solar. This is so big and flat that it's hard to get your bearings in the vast fields of panels, thousands of acres of solar, an industrial sea of solar. EcoMotion has had a 5-person crew on site in the Central Valley for nearly 2 weeks, conducting the inspection at this massive utility-scale installation, methodically moving from row to row of trackers and panels, checking a random 10% for new connectors and wire management. We provide thermographic imaging of findings. It's tedious work. I am proud of the crew, and I reminisce. It was in the early 1990s, Don Osborne was in charge of the Sacramento Municipal Utility District's very exciting and pioneering solar program. He had a far-out dream for the utility and for the solar industry. He believed that if we could just get worldwide solar production to 60 megawatts, we'd hit the tipping point. Then solar would take off. That was just over 30 years ago. Today, there are 1.2 terawatts of solar capacity installed. That's 1,200 gigawatts or 1,200,000 megawatts of solar, 20,000 times Don's dream. In 2008, I remember visiting the world's largest solar system. It was in Leipzig, Germany, the site of a former East German air base. At the time, 10 megawatts was built and made a huge impression on us. We learned that it was so large that its operators could measure the power captured from moonlight. Another 30 megawatts was under construction. They built a special 5-kilometer transmission line to connect the system, and that seemed like a big deal too. But last week, those memories of solar at SMUD are wiped away with the new solar reality. The early German solar tours, memories of large systems, are now dwarfed by our current work, our team immersed in quantum levels more solar, an unimaginable amount of solar, endless acres of solar on single-axis trackers. It's a slow-moving water ballet. Tables of panels start facing east, then shift to the west to catch the afternoon sun. We hear the tables adjusting for maximum insolation, shifting by degrees throughout the sunlit period. And now the net positive perspective radically shifts from really large to really small. I marvel at the simplicity of balcony solar in Germany. Fascinating. For many renters, it's a pair of panels hanging on the balcony railing, like drying laundry. The systems, or kits as they are called, are connected to a microinverter plugged into a wall outlet. They feed electricity directly into the home. On sunny days, the power is enough to power an apartment. This is miles away from utility-scale solar in the Central Valley. Now, hundreds of thousands of Germans have these balcony solar systems. They are mini solar systems, completely behind the meter. They can be bought online or at the supermarket for around $550. Regulations limit their size to 800 watts, enough to power a fridge or charge an e-bike. No need for an electrician or permit. They are easy to install. And thanks to a potent mix of government policies, more than 550,000 have been installed, half of which were installed in 2023. In the first half of 2024, Germany added 220,000 plug-in devices. Now there is a total of 200 megawatts of balcony solar, albeit a fraction of the 16 gigawatts of residential rooftop solar, but a solar contribution where none existed before. The technology for these plug-in microsystems has been around for a decade. They combine panels, a small inverter, and a cord to plug into the household electric socket. In 2019, the German government enacted policies to allow for plug-in solar devices. German lawmakers continued to support balcony solar, earlier this year simplifying permitting and registration requirements. Participants are not required to pay the VAT when buying the systems. Lawmakers also passed a law intended to prevent landlords from arbitrarily blocking installations. Cities throughout Germany have offered millions of euros in subsidies to install balcony solar. Berlin offers 500 euros, about half the cost of a balcony system. Kits now come with a battery option. Homeowners have 5 to 8 year paybacks, depending on the location and shading. The systems are popular, a tangible way to take action. Owners know to use power during sunshine hours to ensure that washing clothes or charging is generated on site and is renewable. Balcony solar kits feature an app that track daily use. It presents a scorecard, something of a game. The systems are increasingly popular in Austria, the Netherlands, and France. From big solar to really small solar, in my view, we need it all. Australian rooftop solar hits 50% of demand. For the first time, Australian rooftop solar has provided 50% of demand on the country's main grid. Rooftop solar reached 50.4% of the country's kWh demand at 1 p.m. on a Saturday. The record set was the aggregate output of solar on millions of Australian households, eclipsing a 49.3% record set 6 days earlier. This moment in time is known as instantaneous demand. Any one moment in time, the power being used, the load supplied. In terms of actual energy delivered, kWh, rooftop solar in Australia provided 11.2% of the country's power supply in 2023, climbing above 10% for the first time. There is now a whopping 22.58 gigawatts of rooftop solar in Australia, some 3.7 million installations, and this is expected to grow fourfold in the coming decades. Households and businesses are going solar to offset soaring electricity prices. Inversely, utilities are selling less power, setting new record lows of coal and gas use. The same week as solar soared, the average coal share over a 7-day period fell to below 50% for the first time. The result of the rooftop solar boom is a new phenomenon called operational demand. It's what's left for utilities and system operators to provide net of solar generation. There are reports that low levels of operational demand are alarming system operators. They face a new reality called minimum system load, minimum amounts of power they deliver given their power plant operations and power purchase contracts. One utility CEO there noted that baseload coal and gas peaker plants no longer fit the modern grid. This might result in using batteries to suck up power in the middle of the day. There's been discussion of curtailing solar. In cases, and at last, baseload power plant operating procedures are changing, now ramping down their output 20% and then up again. This was never done before. The speed of solar development in Australia is breathtaking. The instantaneous share of solar generation was just 38% 3 years ago. 6 years ago, it was 12.6%. Today, it is over 50% and rising. Utilities there are struggling with the death spiral as their higher and higher costs drive more and more consumers away to find their own rooftop power solutions. Heat pumps at scale. It's been years since I visited Stockholm for the first time. It was in the early 1990s, and the European efficiency ethic was in full display in that Swedish city. Massive heat pumps were extracting heat from the city's wastewater system and using the heat. Coolants in the machine sucked away degrees of warmth, that free heat feeding into Stockholm's district heating system. The Atlantic reports on that facility, Stockholm's Hammarbyverket plant, remains the world's largest heat pump. The plant is made up of 7 electric-powered heat pumps, each the size of a 2-story house. It was installed in 1986. I was there in 1988. The impetus for the facility was to wean Sweden off fossil fuels and the volatility of their supply. Stockholm Energy reports that its first heat pumps were pulling heat from IBM mainframe computers. Modern data centers use huge amounts of energy to run and cool their servers. Other energy-intensive industries also produce heat that can be captured by heat pumps. But generally, and even in Europe, heat pump adoption has been held back by the very low cost of burning natural gas, the traditional form of heating. Now climate commitments and the closure of many coal and gas-fired power plants that provide waste heat to district heating systems is bringing heat pump technology to the forefront. A notable and recent heat pump installation is in Esbjerg, Denmark. At that port, the new heat pump system will draw heat from seawater using supercritical CO2 as a refrigerant, pressurized and heated above its critical point. The plant will heat 25,000 households, replacing the heat from the coal plant that will be retired, cutting 120,000 metric tons of annual CO2 emissions. Helsinki, Finland is building a new plant to provide for as much as 40% of its heating requirement. In Vienna, a new system is in place to heat 56,000 households with plans to double its size in the coming years. These are sizable heat pump installations, aligning with shutting down coal plants that have provided the waste heat for the district heating systems. Coal-fired heat is being replaced with heat pumps running on renewable electricity. In the United States, there is a resurgence of interest in heat pump systems in the university sector as schools look for tools to help them follow through on climate commitments. Princeton University is building a large geo-exchange system with ground-source heat pumps that will heat and cool its campus. The system uses hundreds of 850-foot boreholes and a 13-mile distribution network of pipes to transfer heat among 180 buildings. With savings of millions of dollars each year, Princeton plans to phase out natural gas and to achieve net zero emissions by 2046, the school's 300th anniversary. Space-based solar power. Space-based solar power, SSP, could prove transformative, says an October article in Power magazine. It references a paper presented by the American Foreign Policy Council, written by Cody Rutherford. He claims that SSP could provide efficient, continuous clean energy from orbit. Recent developments, including low-cost space access, mass-produced satellites, robotics, and other commercial-led innovations will unlock this capability within the next 10 to 20 years, he says. We think solar in terrestrial terms. Imagine collecting power from space. Then energy will be wirelessly sent to Earth using microwaves or laser beams. Space-generated power will be collected at ground-receiving stations. Just as satellite technologies have revolutionized communications and global navigation systems, SPP has the potential to revolutionize power, using satellites that collect power 24 hours a day. China has a SSP program and wants to become a global space power by 2045. Rutherford describes electricity applications, industrial applications, transportation applications, and military applications for SSP. Bidirectional EV charging. Imagine if every car sitting in a garage or parking lot was connected to the grid. Imagine subscription plans that allow your electric utility to draw energy from your EV and to pay you handsomely for it. Imagine EVs and their onboard power supplies could be used to avoid utilities having to build billions of dollars of power plants that will only be used 30 to 40 hours a year. There may well be a win-win for this integration at significant scale. Imagine that the grid fails, a power outage, planned or unplanned, and your plugged-in EV powers your home. That's VGI, vehicle grid integration. For most of us, that's in the future. Our cars supporting home microgrids and virtual power plants, VPPs. The Ford Lightning has received lots of deserved attention. America's number one selling pickup, the F-150, is now sold in an electric model. It has 150 kilowatt-hours of energy storage on board, and it is bidirectional, meaning that it can be charged from the grid, and in theory, it can return power to your home. In the future, your Ford F-150 may well be part of a utility program. Enough F-150s connected and willing to discharge all at once, and the capacity savings can be rather large. That's the good news. The bad news is the cost. Ford does offer a system for the Lightning. It costs one driver $18,000, combining Sunrun's home integration system with Ford's intelligent backup power, what the owner calls hideously expensive. Nearly $10,000 of that was for the home integration system. For the rest of us EV drivers, those in Teslas, Chevrolets, Nissans, etc., we are not quite there. For the vehicle to power your home, you need to think wiring. You'll need a power inlet socket backed by a critical load subpanel, which can be isolated with an automatic transfer switch. Most older and smaller homes, which typically have 100 amp panels, need new electrical panels too. The Lightning draws 80 amps when charging. Thankfully, plug-and-play systems are on the horizon. In September, California took one step forward in preparing and promoting the VGI scenario presented above. SB 39 has passed and has been signed by the governor. It requires that all EVs sold in the state have bidirectional charging capability. A predecessor bill that failed, SB 233, called for all vehicles to have VGI by 2030. SB 59 does not have a specific date, leaving the regulation up to the California Energy Commission, Air Resources Board, and Public Utilities Commission. Utilities, by many accounts, are not embracing VGI, but there are interesting pilot programs. Southern California Edison has proposed a tariff that would pay EV drivers 58 cents per kilowatt hour for power from their EVs between 6 and 9 p.m. June through September. Home Depot purging plastics. Home Depot is the world's largest home improvement retailer. Now it is taking steps to eliminate expanded polystyrene foam and polyvinyl chloride plastic film from packaging used for its private labeled products. Both are listed as problematic by the U.S. Plastics Pact, an organization that guides corporate commitments to phase out plastic packaging. The Home Depot initiative involves the redesign of packaging for 1,300 products for its own brands, from ceiling fans to light bulbs and bathroom vanity counters. In 2023, the initiative reduced polystyrene foam by 6 million cubic feet, enough to fill 67 Olympic-sized pools, and 39 million square feet of plastic films, enough to cover 513 soccer fields. Home Depot has not characterized the packaging change in terms of climate protection. The packaging is lighter, allowing for more product on its shelves and more product packed into its trucks. It is tapping a win-win between the environment and the economy. The company's next goal is to transition by 2028 to fiber-based packaging that is compostable, recyclable, or made of recycled contents. That will mean a shift to molded pulp, paper, and paperboard. Home Depot's goal is to improve the protection it provides, for instance, using corrugated cardboard corners that keep items from sliding around in boxes with minimal material. Climate change course now required at UC San Diego. University of California at San Diego has implemented a new graduation requirement. All students enrolled this fall and from here on are now required to take a course on climate change. Eligible courses must have at least 30% climate-related content and address two of four areas: scientific foundations, human impacts, mitigation strategies, and project-based learning. About 7,000 students from the class of 2028 are affected. According to a Scripps Institution of Oceanography professor, the goal is preparing students for the future that they will really encounter. Fully 41 courses meet the requirements, including the astronomy of climate change, gender and climate justice, indigenous approaches to climate change, and environmentalism in art and media. Students reportedly support the requirement. For some, it will introduce them to new career paths, perhaps opportunities in climate-adjacent fields such as carbon accounting and civil engineering. Fully 85% of Gen Z is very or somewhat concerned about the climate crisis, and they, more than any other generation, believe it is mostly caused by human activity. Similarly, California, New Jersey, and other states are requiring that their young students learn about the climate crisis in grade school. Arizona State University implemented a sustainability requirement for graduation this year. Columbia, Harvard, and Stanford have created entire schools devoted to climate change and our response to the crisis at hand.
That's it. Thanks for listening to Flanagan's Ecologic. We'll see you next time.